Be who you are. Dream what you really want to do. Then, do it. Be, Dream, Do. Living by Design, the radio show, is focused on people sharing their stories of how they were able to understand what they were really passionate about, had the courage to dream big, and then did it. Now, join the conversation.
Well, hello there, listeners. Welcome back to Be, Dream, Do. This is Dave Whitehorn, your host, and I'm here with son, Sean.
Morning.
And we are absolutely thrilled to have a dear family friend and Emmy-winning composer and musician extraordinaire, Silas Height, with us. Silas, hello.
Hello. Thank you for such a nice introduction. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's just great to have you. Just great to have you. So, Silas, you have, you know, we've been following you for years. I mean, you know, since we met you up at the days up at Orm when you were going to school there, and being a good friend of our oldest son here. So we've been following you. And one thing that just really, really struck me every time I talked to you is that you were just so passionate about whatever you were doing. I mean, you always had that smile on your face, you know, a high level of energy, and it always had something to do with music. So, as you know, yeah, our show is about helping people understand how they can land something that they really, really love. And that's because there was this survey that was done by Gallup last year, and they found out that only 15% of the people that they surveyed, and they surveyed millions of workers around the world, loved what they did. Now, what a waste. And so yeah, here you are, just, you know, not only loving what you do, but making a good living at it and doing some really creative and interesting things. So, Silas, would you share with us, how did it all start?
Sure. I suppose it started when I was younger, and I had a love of music from a pretty young age. My dad plays instruments and was always playing guitar in the house, and my mom would pick up instruments now and then and tinker with them. And my uncles were in a band called Devo, and I grew up, you know, listening to their music and feeling like it was, you know, just relating to it and seeing people actually making a living doing music after their band sort of slowed down in the early 80s. They went on to be composers and have a successful career. And so I was kind of drawn to music at an early age. And then throughout high school and college, I just, you know, the feeling just intensified. And at some point I realized that I would, you know, I was going to do something creative, and music was what I was most drawn to. And then, you know, I just decided to throw my energy into it and go for it.
So, you know, Silas, that's fascinating. And there's so many of us collectively, I'm sure this connects with a lot of listeners out there, that, you know, we all have music in our past in some way, shape, or form, or in our present. But it's more in the space of, you know, this is what I do, you know, in my spare time or as a hobby, you know, this kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through this, you know, seventh, eighth grade kind of, you know, got my guitar, you know, I remember, you know, learning how to play my first chords and all this stuff. But you went from there into actually, you know, deciding to make a living out of it. When did that happen?
I think in college, I decided that, you know, I was actually studying music, art, and business, all three together, because I knew I wanted to do music, but art kind of felt like the same thing as music to me, just expressed, I guess, more quietly. But it felt like the same sort of, I don't know, brain exercise or creativity. So I was studying both music and art. But then I also, you know, I started to realize, okay, to make a living doing music is obviously difficult. And I saw a lot of people not be able to do it that were really passionate about it. And so I saw that, okay, it takes more than talent, it takes more than passion. It also takes, you know, hard work, but also probably some business, either smarts or, you know, education or whatever. And so I took some business classes as well. I also kind of observed that everyone in my family was either self-employed or had started their own businesses or a combination of both. And so I kind of figured, well, you know, it seems to be a common theme with my with my family that, you know, we're probably not I'm probably not going to have a boss for long. I'm probably going to want to do my own thing.
Yeah.
And so I figured, you know, having some business training behind that would probably be a good idea.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, you know, I lost. What was the original question again?
Well, you know, I mean, just basically, no, you're right on, Silas. I mean, just kind of exploring where you decided to actually get into business, right? To make a living out of this.
When did you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when did you know that this is what you wanted to do? You answered the question right away. Well, when you were in college, I guess one of the things that we've discovered here often is that people that are on the creative side lose energy when you get into the, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's that you need to do in business. Where did you find the energy to do that?
Well, frankly, I mean, that is the least fun part. I am, at this point, I've been a freelance composer for about 8 years.
Yeah.
And it's just me. I don't have a team or anything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so I do frequently have to read contracts or do, you know, publicity type things and do, you know, the more mundane, update my website, those kind of things, which, no, I don't want to be doing that. I would much rather be just writing music, you know, but what I have to look at is, hey, you know, this is what allows you to have the lifestyle that you want, which is mostly just creating every day and not having to go into someone else's office and not having a boss. And so I just remind myself of that. And also, I think my parents instilled a really strong work ethic in me. They're both very hard workers. And I, as a kid and growing up as a teenager as well, like doing manual labor with my dad, like building houses and doing excavation and things like that. There's much harder ways to earn a dollar, at least harder on your body. You know what I mean? Especially in Arizona where it's very hot out,
right.
You know, working in the sun. And I think I learned, like, I have great respect for that work, but it's not for me.
Right,
and so I think when I get down on them, like, oh, I don't want to fill out the metadata for these songs on this Excel spreadsheet. I think, you know what? It's a lot easier than being out there putting on a roof on a house when it's 110 out. So suck it up. You can do it, you know? So I think having that strong work ethic and a background of, you know, different types of jobs and labor helps.
Yeah, that's insightful, very insightful, Silas, because so many times people aren't willing to do the side of the business that isn't all sexy, for lack of a better word.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And that's the discipline that really makes the difference.
Yep. I find that's where most freelancers or want to be freelance creative types fall short. They're not able to do that. They're uncomfortable having business conversations or talking about contracts, let alone reading them or, you know, writing them, things like that.
Uh-huh.
They're unable, and so they shy away from it. And in the end, if you only focus on creating, you're not going to be able to sustain unless it's a very rare situation.
Mm-hmm. So it was this experience you had when you were younger doing labor work and whatnot and observing others doing it that helped build those discipline muscles, I guess is what I hear you saying.
I think so. Yeah, okay. I think so.
Yeah.
And then later, so after college, I got a job as an intern. I had my foot in the door was my uncle's owned a studio where I was an intern, but then worked my way into being a composer there for about 7 years. And, but my uncles were working there too as composers. And I saw how much work that they put in. And particularly my uncle Mark had art projects and art shows going at the same time, scoring lots of different projects and just saying yes to everything and just making it happen. And I think that further influence of just the hard work ethic, you know, rubbed off on me as well.
And was it sort of like a mentor situation or just teamwork? You're just working with teams and just taking all these projects?
You know, it was kind of a combination. So by the time I worked my way into being a composer, I wasn't really working with Mark, like, you know, side by side writing music together or anything like that. But I was working with these two other composers, and we were sort of a team that worked there. We would score lots of projects, and Mark was sort of he would give us guidance, you know, and say, hey, try this, do this, why don't we hire, you know, this player? He'll really bring it together, that sort of thing. And so he was kind of getting the projects, giving us guidance and direction, and then turning us loose on it, and then, you know, kind of steering the ship in a sense. And then, of course, he was helming his own projects at the time. Most memorably for me was the Wes Anderson movie, The Life Aquatic. Music he wrote for that was just, that was a learning experience, just listening to the music coming out of his studio and, you know, going in there and hearing him create that score and just hearing this wonderful creativity. And then, you know, that it, the director wanted old synths on it, and Mark has an amazing collection. And, you know, I set a bunch of them up for him and said, Mark, show me how these work. You know, why are these amazing? And, you know, experiences like that were more of a mentor type situation. But really just getting the opportunity to hone my chops as a composer and learn on the job with these amazing projects that demanded the highest level of quality, you know, because we're talking about very high profile clients. It was really that opportunity that was big.
You've done a lot of great things here, Silas. Would you just share some of the things that you're most proud of?
Yeah, I think that I did one of them that was kind of earlier in my career was an Apple commercial, and it was the two guys, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, and I wrote the music for that, you know, series of commercials, which ended up being like 80 or 90 iterations, different versions of that commercial. And it you know, it aired all over the world for about 5 years, and it was playing in all the Apple stores for years, and that was kind of a cool thing. I've done some big video games, like particularly the Sims games, and those are really cool. And recently, Sean, I heard you say the Ocean's 8. Yeah, I did a trailer for that movie that was pretty cool, and so all kinds of stuff. And frankly, it's like they've just been coming fast and furious for the past, you know, 14 years or 15 years. So it's kind of hard to keep track. But sometimes I'll go to my website and look back and go, oh my gosh,
it's, you know, amazing.
What a lucky run.
Yeah, it's been a lot of hard work for sure, Silas. I'm curious when someone says, look, we want you to do a score for us, right? You know, how do you get there? How do you do that?
Well, So normally there's discussion about what they're looking for. For instance, they may say, oh, I like the work that you did on, you know, Chef's Table. I like the, you know, the live strings and the sort of classical feel of that score. Could you do, you know, something kind of like that? But my film is more, let's say there's more of a, you know, a technology component. So let's make it sound more modern and maybe add some electronic instruments. Or maybe they don't know how to get that sound, but I would suggest that. You know, if they have a conversation about the tone of their film, what they're trying to achieve, you know, the basic moods, like we want this to be very hopeful, you know? And so to me, that tells me certain things. That tells me like, I'm going to use instruments and chord progressions and melodies that are more hopeful and things like that. So it starts with some conversations. Yeah. They may play me music that they feel like is close to what they're looking for, or they may ask me to go through my library and find things that I think might work. And so there's a little bit of back and forth in the beginning where you're sort of trying to figure out the tone. And then I just ask for, you know, whatever rough cut they have of their film, meaning it's probably not done being edited or in its final form, but it's getting close. So they'll send me some scenes and I'll just start experimenting and trying and see what I think works with it. And at this point, I don't really overthink it too much. I, you know, I've got a lot of experience, so I just sort of let my
instincts
my instincts kind of just take over. And so I pick up an instrument that I feel is appropriate for the mood or the tone, and then I just start and I just kind of let my hands go for it.
Well, I mean, I don't know if the listeners are aware, I mean, we've announced it in the past, but the music that's on our show is your music, and you did an incredible job. You and I went back and forth a couple of times, and I said, kind of, this is the B-Dream Do kind of thing. And you put together some really cool stuff that, in my mind, is truly inspirational. So I certainly thank you for that. So being able to work with the master, I've seen it actually in action. So thank you.
You're very welcome.
So when you're making music, is it like... is it like an exploration? Are you like discovering sounds together? Are you channeling this energy? Like, what does like music mean to you in that sense?
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of exploration, and I'm always trying to push it further and not just repeat myself. I don't want to make the same music for one project that I made for the last one, you know, because no two projects are the same, and it needs to be a reflection of what you're seeing on screen. But also for my own sanity and pleasure, I guess, exploring new sounds and new ways of expressing emotion and things like that. So I do that partially by collecting different instruments. I play a lot of instruments, and I play some of them well, and I play some of them not very well, but it's not really even about that. It's about just getting new sounds and seeing what I can coax out of it. Mm-hmm. That's where I find a lot of inspiration.
That's cool. Have any projects ever sort of taken you in a new direction that you were just like shocked by, I guess?
I guess Chef's Table, for example, that was a very classical kind of approach, and I knew that I would have live stream players, and I never, I don't think up until that point, I hadn't had too many opportunities to really write that much music, like a big, you know, a big bulk, a chunk of music, and know that it was going to be performed by live players. So that was definitely exercising a different muscle, and I felt like I felt confident that I could do it. I just hadn't had the opportunity. So that was really a new direction, which was great. And, you know, has brought in a lot of other work. People are fans of that music. And so I'm getting to do more string-based scores, which is really fun, and hiring more players. Because when a director or a producer hears that music and I can say, those are live players, and that's why it sounds so amazing, they're willing to add a little to their budget so that they can have live players and really get that sound, because it makes such a huge difference having humans contribute their humanity to a project rather than just sample the sounds.
Electrical sounds,
That's awesome. Have you ever worked on a project, because you said you go with your instincts and you built this this skill within yourself from your experience. Have you ever had a project where you were just kind of like really stumped about where you wanted to go with it, and then like you had to like, you know, sort of research or dig in, or I don't know, and then anything like that?
Sometimes. Usually that will happen. I find that happens more with like inexperienced directors where they don't really know what they want either.
Okay.
And so I may come up with a tone and, you know, and a set of instruments and a sound for their movie that I think is great. And so, you know, this is at the beginning of a project. And so I might score us three or four scenes in this particular way to kind of give an overview of the style and tone. And, you know, we may abandon it completely, and they might say, you know what, that doesn't anything else. And I'm like, okay, you know, and I'll try that. So usually I'm able to reinterpret and try things in multiple ways, which can be difficult for sure, but I'm kind of used to having to do that. But it usually there's only this problem of back and forth and not figuring out when the director isn't able to make a decision and like commit to something.
Okay.
You know, when they're a bit wishy-washy and can't figure out the tone of their own film. So that's usually when that happens.
I guess that's natural, I guess. And I mean, that's probably why they come to you to help get some sort of inspiration, I guess, at the end of the day.
People
don't know what they want, and so you just throw out a couple of ideas, and finally, after some conversation, it finally hits, and after throwing out a few things, I guess they find something, and then they don't. When they find it, then they know that's it.
Exactly, dude. You hit on it with the come to me for inspiration. Sometimes, you know, I'll tell them, hey, don't feel bad, especially at these beginning stages.
Yeah.
We're just trying stuff. We're getting the conversation going. If we come up with things that you don't like, that's fine. Then we can eliminate those options and we can move towards something you do like, you know? So in the beginning, there is that experimental kind of phase, which is actually can be fun to just really try different things and see what you get to stick.
Mm-hmm. And so what's life like being in high demand?
It's busy. I do so many commercial scores where, you know, the turnaround is insanely quick. Like I might get a call, hey, are you available to work on this commercial? And I'll literally start it that day and need to turn in music the next day.
Oh my.
And so that can be tough, because that means it's harder to plan vacations.
Yeah.
It's harder to just take time off, or focus on only one thing. So you know, but it's a balance. I feel like I've got a pretty good grip on a work life kind of flow at this point. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm really into what I do. I love writing music, so I don't mind being busy. I like really getting into it and working on multiple projects at the same time and just hunkering down and scoring like crazy. And, fortunately, my wife is very in demand and very busy with her career too. So we're, right. you know, she's understanding about that, and we still make plenty of time for each other, and we do have a lot of fun. But yeah, it can be tough for sure. Mostly, I would say just the unpredictability of commercials makes it difficult. But the upside of scoring commercials is their budgets are the best compared right. to movies or TV shows or video games. They they pay the most for, you know, a small amount of music. And so it's the kind of thing you don't want to turn down and say, oh, no, sorry. I was going to relax by the pool today. You know, you don't say that. You say, yeah, I'll hop on it right now.
Well, pretty soon you say no enough and they stop calling you, I guess, right?
Exactly. Yep. You hit on the real truth of it there. Yeah, when you're a freelancer, you can't really afford to say no because clients won't come back if you say no, you know?
Well, Silas, you know, you've shared with us how you've just really been able to knock the ball out of the park in so many different ways with scoring music and so many different productions and commercials and whatnot. But you do much more than that. And I have been following your career as a musician and composer with Satin Cowboy. So talk to us about that.
Sure. So Satin Cowboy is the name of the band is The Satin Cowboy and the Seven Deadly Sins. And it's basically just a recording project that I have. And it's an outlet for me to write Americana, you know, country inspired type songs. Kind of like where country and rock and bluegrass meet together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of influences there, but like Tom Petty's more country type stuff or the Traveling Wilburys, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And it's basically just me playing all the instruments. And I ask friends that are into it if they want to play, you know, for different things. If I feel like they're going to bring something interesting to the table. And of course your son, Patrick is obviously a very talented artist, and he did your Be Dream Do logo, which
yeah.
I love.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he has done all of the artwork for my records, and he's sort of been a sounding board. I bounce ideas off of him, and we chat about it quite a bit, which is really helpful since this is basically a one-man project. But yeah, it's just sort of an outlet where there's no client involved. It's just me. I don't have the pressure of, oh my gosh, I have to go tour, or I have yeah. to sell so many records to pay back the record label or anything.
Right,
I just make these albums for myself to put out as just sort of a creative outlet. And having that creative outlet where nobody else, you know, can tell me what to do or what to change, I think is really important and allows me to then go do, you know, music for clients where they're calling the shots and they can say, change this, I don't like this, you know, do
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And I sort of, that helps me with the balance where I don't feel like I'm just working for someone else all the time. You know, I can create on my own. And then fortunately, you know, the music has hit a chord, so to speak, you know, and there, I do have people that really like it and are looking sure. forward to when I release something. And, you know, I get emails saying that they like it and things like that. And it's gotten a little bit of radio play, you know, here and there.
You've got so what, four albums, I think you've done it, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm halfway through the next one. So hopefully, I don't know, the summer's really booking up with projects, but hopefully I have a little downtime to work on it. I basically have to work on it in between, you know, the paying projects. But
yeah. But it's interesting okay. what you said that, you know, you're investing time in creating something where no one else can have any say over it actually feeds you. It gives you the energy to get through the other projects where people are telling you do this and do that. And that's pretty mm-hmm. fascinating, Silas. That's pretty fascinating.
It's proof that you love music.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it really is what I want to be doing, you know, with my time. And you had asked earlier in the interview about, like, how did you know what
yeah.
you wanted to do with right. your life or as a career? And I told you, like, I felt like I had a strong work ethic and mm-hmm. I, you know, I had a solid platform to jump off of. You know, fortunately, I had a very loving and supportive family, and I was, right. you know, I got a college, a great education at Orm and then at University of Arizona. And so I figured, you know, I asked myself, what do you like to do when you don't have to do anything else, when you don't have any obligations? And really, it was just pick up a guitar and mess around, or pick up an instrument and see what I could make with it. You know, and at that point, I wasn't writing songs or really composing or anything. I wasn't quite there yet, but it was still that impulse that I was really drawn to and just wanted to express myself in that way.
Yeah, that really is exciting. What was your biggest challenge as you were moving from, you know, playing the guitar just to do things when you had no other obligations to actually creating the space where the music you played created obligations?
Well, I think it was, you know, probably when I got my internship at Mutato, you know, and I was walking the dog, making coffee, things like that. They let me start demoing, meaning writing music for commercials, because what would happen is everybody in the studio would write, you know, some tracks, and we would send them to the client, and the client would pick what they liked. And so it didn't hurt to let me write some demos and throw it in. But eventually the client started picking my tracks more and more and more. And so pretty soon they gave me a studio, and I wasn't walking the dog and making coffee. I was, you know, they were like, get in there and write music, 'cause it's selling. it was just a progression. And what I had to overcome was my lack of, you have to learn to write in a specific way for commercials or for TV or for film. It's very different than just writing a song. And that's why some musicians that are in bands become great composers. My uncle's a good example. But a lot of people that are in bands that may be excellent songwriters aren't necessarily good composers, because it is a different skill. You're doing something else.
Right.
It's a different skill set. So I had to learn those skills. It's also something that you don't really learn in college, or at least when I was going to college, you know, we weren't really scoring to picture or doing anything like that. And so I had to learn it on the job slowly. But, you know, fortunately, I was able to pick it up and learn from the other composers around me and kind of get a feel for it. And the other thing, too, is you have to be able to make it sound very professional, meaning mix-wise and production-wise.
Right.
It's got to sound very polished and, you know, great. And so that's definitely a skill set that I'm, you know, every musician works on throughout their life. You know, it's something that's always, you're always chasing, but I had to learn very quickly if I wanted to sell music and continue to make a living doing it, to get my skills up to speed. So I read a lot, practiced a lot, you know, asked questions a lot until I got there.
So with the reading that you've done, I mean, do you have a favorite book out there?
Music related or just otherwise?
Well, otherwise, I mean, I don't know. I'm just a wide open question.
You know, in relation to this show, I think there's a wonderful book called The Artist's Way.
Okay.
And particularly for those that would like a career in a more creative field, it's a book to sort of help get you on track and figure out, you know, maybe where you're going off track. And it's kind of like it kind of does give you exercises to do, which I think is like kind of a common thing these days. There's probably a lot of books like that. But I did use this one at some point in my life before I sort of had a career doing something creative. And I found it to be really inspirational, and a good read and a lot of good thoughts and exercises in it. It's called The Artist's Way. So if you're looking for a life of creativity and hopefully making a living doing it, I would recommend that book.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I appreciate that. Who in particular inspired you the most, Silas?
I mean, career-wise, I guess.
Yeah.
I would have to say my parents, probably. Music always seemed like an important thing, and something to, you know, something to be revered and loved. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I told my dad when I was 11, I told my folks I wanted to take drum lessons. And, you know, we lived in the middle of nowhere in this tiny town in Arizona, you know, about 100 people there.
Yeah.
There's no pavement, let alone a music store, you know, there's a saloon and a general store. So they're like, okay, well, we have to go to Prescott for groceries every couple of weeks. There's a music store there. We'll go in, see if we can, you know, you can take lessons when you go in or something. We went in and they said, you know, it's oddly enough, our drum teacher lives in the desert below Crown King. And he's, you know, it's still about an hour from your house, but it's closer than coming here. Yeah. And so my dad and I actually both started taking drum lessons from him. And we drive down once a week, you know, on dirt road out to the middle of nowhere and find this guy. And he was, his name was Mel Zelnick. And he was an old jazz drummer who had played with Benny Goodman and Patti Page and like had quite an illustrious career and was a great teacher. He studied with him and kind of learned the basics there, but it just always seemed like, you know, my parents were like, music was an important thing. My dad we would talk about music and he'd be like, do you hear that guitar riff, the way it fits in around the other instruments? Or do you hear, you know, how that bass player just is locked into that groove, things like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, seeing my uncles, as these really creative, I mean, they weren't just, some people know Devo as Whip It. They had a, you know, they're just one hit wonder, but they had a really creative, their band was very artistic and doing visual art and music videos before other people were doing music videos before MTV. Mm-hmm. And, I found that to be very inspirational. So I guess my family is my biggest inspiration really.
That's great. What doubts did you have as you went along?
Well, I think just the big, you know, reality that how many successful composers can there be in the world? Probably not that many.
Yeah.
Also, you know, just a life in art or music is it's a tough bet. You're taking a real gamble. You know what I mean? That there's some jobs where, I mean, nothing's guaranteed in life, but there are some jobs where it's like you go to school, you take the right classes. Yeah, you're probably going to have a job in that career and you're probably going to be set up and be okay. You know, you know, nothing's given, but there are some more safe traditional type paths to take. So of course it was a doubt. That's also part of why I took some business classes and wanted to, and made sure I got my college degree was just in case this doesn't work out, you know, at least hopefully I'll be set up to sort of pivot and do something else. And I told myself, I was going to give it my all until I was 30 with music, you know, and then if it just, you know, if I was broke and it just wasn't working out, then I would shift gears and point myself in a different direction and just let it be a hobby. But fortunately, you know, I was able to make it work.
It's kind of like you were hedging your bets a little bit so that you kind of helping mitigate the risk. But when you said you were going to give it your all, it sounds like you really truly gave it your all.
I think I did. I mean, When I graduated, you know, well, first of all, in college, I, you know, was studying three different things at the same time, but it was all pointing in the same direction, you know, supporting this music career.
Yeah.
I was interning at the recording studio they had there on campus, and I was playing in bands just to play music as much as possible. So it was my whole life. And then, you know, as soon as I graduated, I started work a few days later in Los Angeles. And prior to that, I came out and talked to my uncle about, hey, can I get an internship with you? And he was really, he's very sweet and loving, but he was like, well, I don't know. We haven't actually hired a composer here in a long time. And you're very young. And also I've never hired, like hiring family is always kind of dicey.
Yeah.
And also he didn't know me that well, to be fair.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I'm moving out here one way or the other. I totally understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
If you can give me a trial period, I will be your hardest worker. I guarantee it. Cause I knew I could at least do that. And so God bless him. He did. He was like, all right, I'll give you a shot. And, I mean, I would get up and go to work. I would get up at 4 a.m. and I would be there hours before everyone else rolled in at 10 a.m. You know, and I would be there for just hours and hours writing music and just trying to get better and better. And I just, you know, really gave it all my energy, which I think was, it's what I needed to do to show that I was serious about it. I also needed that much time to just, you know, get up to speed with everything. And also I think it was a good thing to bring to the company too. This blast of young energy and enthusiasm, I think was good. And I think other people appreciated it. I hope there, but he obviously did because then he hired me on full time and, you know, I worked there for a good 7 or 8 years.
You know, but I mean, you bring up a good point, Silas, and I hope the listeners are taking note. It's not just enough to love what you're doing, all right? You got to have the chutzpah. You got to have the backbone to really love it so much that you're really willing to sacrifice. And you said that, you know, I wanted to show others that I was serious about this. And so there you are, you know, at 4 in the morning, you know, going in early to get a jump on things. That's what separated you from others, I guess I would say. The other thing is, and I don't know if this resonates with you, but it's been my experience in talking to other people here on this show and you know, and in the work that I do in my own business, is that when people are actually so invested in what they do, it's that the energy feeds the energy. I don't know. It's almost, I don't know. It kind of gives you goosebumps when you think about it, right? But it almost, you'd think that it would beat you up and kind of take it out of you. But if you really love what you're doing, and then you combine that with doing it and really trying to send a message, and you get some positive feedback, you know, that helps certainly. But it just seems to just kind of come into a crescendo. I wanted to pull in a musical term for you, Silas.
You know. Well done.
I don't know. That's kind of how I feel about this. Was that your experience?
Yes, I think so. Honestly, the busier I get, I don't get worn out. I just get more creative and more into it. It's awesome. And so it just keeps feeding and it's on itself. It's like a feedback loop, another musical term, where it just keeps growing and growing on itself. And I love it. And I think that, you know, if it was just a job where I was clocking in, I would, you know, not, because there's no way you can only do it from 9 to 5. I work pretty much 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And I start real early. And, but then, you know, if there's times I want to stop or need to stop, you know, need some inspiration or just have to do real life things, like, you know, go to the doctor or something, I am my own boss and I do have control on my schedule. And so I can do that. And that's the trade-off, but it's just really, you know, it's integrated into my life. It's what I want to do. And I feel like that's kind of the definition of success, is being able to just live my life the way I want to without a boss, and being able to spend time doing what I love and just be fully engaged in it, you know?
How fulfilled do you think you are right now?
Oh, I feel very fulfilled. I feel very fulfilled. I've got a wonderful, loving relationship and an awesome family, and I've been able to build a studio for myself so I can make music all the time, and I feel very grateful, and I've got wonderful projects coming in all the time that keep me on my toes, and, you know, a lot of repeat clients, which I really enjoy that, because I really like forming long-term relationships with my clients, whether they're, you know, directors or producers or editors or whatever, because you get to know each other and the work really benefits. The more you know someone and the more I can really get to the bottom of what they want for their project, like that really interests me and feeds my fire. So I like that a lot, and I have a lot of those repeat customers, which makes me really happy, and because also obviously they're happy with my music, and that's a great feeling when a director or someone says, you know, you really just nailed the tone of my film, really got what I was going for, thank you, you know. And so I feel very fulfilled and very lucky.
How was the transition when you went to be a solo worker?
Oh, it was hard.
Because you're talking about your clientele. But yeah.
It was like starting all over again. So I started at Mutato, worked my way up from nothing, from being a college kid, intern, all the way up to, you know, scoring TV shows, movies, video games, commercials, nonstop, every day, just, you know, tons and tons of work, like crazy. Then the recession hit and it was pretty bad. And, you know, I mean, I would say 50% of my friends were out of work at least. And even though I had a job, the project had begun to slow down at this studio, and, you know, it was kind of tough, but at the same time, I had had my eye on going freelance for a long time. It was always kind of part of my plan. And I had saved up a lot of money so that I could make that leap and bought the equipment that I would need and instruments and things like that.
Right.
But then the recession hit and I was watching my bank account start to, you know, that savings start to dwindle. And I thought, I think I need to do this now before those reserves are gone, yeah. A, and then B, it coincided with getting married to my wife. And she moved here from Akron, Ohio, and she was working in East Los Angeles as a principal. And so she moved here, we got married. It was very romantic, but then right away we realized we're working so much we never see each other. This isn't what we wanted. So we both decided to quit our jobs at the same time, which I wouldn't advise normally. But it turned out great for us. She found a really great job working from home, and I, you know, set about being a freelance composer. But you said something about, you know, clients, and the problem was the clients I had at Mutato were my uncle's clients.
You're right.
And so when I left, I wasn't going to, you know, try and steal them or anything.
Of course
not. They were his.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I mean, yeah, he's family. So I couldn't do that. But so that was really tough, you know. So that meant I was starting over and contacting a lot of people, like basically cold calling, right? And going to events and trying to network and things like that. The one thing I had going for me was that if I actually got people to listen to my music or look at the list of clients that I'd worked with in the past, all of a sudden they were like, oh, wow, you've been doing this. You really, you know, you have a great client list.
Yeah.
I should, you know, i.e. I should trust you with my project or give you a chance.
Right.
And so if I could get them, you know, if I could get that in front of them, some of them would give me a chance. And so I slowly built up from there, from having, you know, basically no clients to slowly getting some. And then, you know, you've got these repeat people and then they start recommending you to other people. And, you know, and I just did a lot of quote unquote pavement pounding, which I guess is mostly digital these days, but, you know, just really trying to drum up work. And that's where I think not only the work ethic, but also the business classes where that stuff really kicked in and helped me out.
Right.
With, you know, some knowledge of promotion and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think you have to have good people skills to be a composer. And honestly, I've met a lot of composers who don't have that. They're, you know, they're introverts who like to be in a studio alone working on music, which
right.
I like to be in a studio alone working on music too. But at the end of the day, you have to work with other people on your projects if you're going to be scoring for, you know, someone else's projects. And so you have to be a good people person who people want to be around and work with and talk to. And so fortunately, I think I am. And so I was able to also, you know, I kind of had that at my disposal, which was kind of nice too, and was able to make it happen and go out and meet people and in person and try and hustle that way as well. And eventually, you know, at this point I don't do much. I don't really have to go look for new work. It just keeps coming in and coming in and coming in. So I'm really grateful for that.
Did you learn something about yourself when you started doing your own projects that you didn't know you had in you from before when you're working this internship?
Well, you know, I think that slowly I started finding my own voice musically, because, you know, when I was working at this other studio, they would come there and most of the time the clients wanted the music to sound like it came from Mark. Like they, like for example, they'd say, we love the sound of your Wes Anderson scores. Can you do something inspired by that? Now, I love those scores as well, and I was very happy to do that. And, of course, it's going to kind of sound like me because I'm doing it.
Yeah.
But also I had to be like, okay, how would this sound if Mark wrote it? You know what I mean? Or yeah. It needs to sound like it's coming from this studio in particular. Right. So when I left there, that pressure was gone. I mean, I still get references for other people's music. I mean, that's just a part of what we do where they're like,
sure.
Oh, I love, you know, I love John Williams' Star Wars score. Can you make it sound like that? Whatever. But... But, you know, I started getting projects where the directors were more open and I could really explore more and started coming up with my own sound. And I think I'm still doing that and I'm in the process of it. But I think that was one of the big discoveries about myself was, wow, now I get to really define who I am and what I sound like. And I think the only thing is I shoot myself in the foot a little bit because I do explore so many different styles of music. So one person might know me for my satin cowboy music.
Right.
And someone
right.
else. For my chef's table music, which is very different, and you know, so it might be.
And your
I would say
band.
In a marketing world, in a marketing sense, it's better to be known for one thing, but that doesn't interest me. So,
yeah,
it's awesome.
Wow. Well, I'm really curious. How do you cold call? How do you cold call selling music for a commercial?
Well, yeah, no, it's a good question. Mostly there are music houses that are hired by ad agencies
okay.
to supply the music. So most of the time I would contact music houses and say, hey, do you hire freelancers? Uh-huh. If so, here's a lot of the projects I've done before. And so normally it's, you know, email these days also so that I okay. can send links to, you know, YouTube or just audio files or whatever.
Right.
And a lot of times you don't hear back, but if they did take the time to click on it, they would see that, it, you know, I've done a lot of them and I've won awards for it and things like that. And like, oh, let's give this guy a shot. And so, you know, that's kind of how I do that with, would do that with commercials.
Yeah, yeah. So you're not humming a tune over the phone or anything like that?
No.
Hey, how does this sound?
Hey, what do you think, Dad? Just imagine a hot day at a beach. That's what I was thinking about.
Well, I tell you what, Silas, I like your music so much. I don't ever hop in the car and travel without, you know, putting your music on. And, you know, I just had to go up to Vegas for a 3-day conference and. And I took that road up. I'm sure you know the road up to Vegas from Phoenix, right? Mm-hmm. So took that road up, and I was just rocking to your music. And I had it up louder probably than what most people would have. But I like to feel the music, and you use a lot of different instruments and percussion and whatnot. I'm still waiting to hear a cuica in your music. I haven't heard a cuica yet.
If you listen to, you can go on either iTunes or on my website or on SoundCloud or whatever. And look up a movie called The Record Breaker.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful documentary about the man who has the most records in the Guinness Book of World Records.
What? Okay.
And most of them are really quirky, weird things like how many malt balls can he eat in 1 minute while balancing on the back of an elephant? Like things like that. And so the score had to be kind of quirky and goofy. And so I did one song called, in particular, Brian's Batacuda. And
Batacuda. Okay, yeah.
Nice.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Brian was the director, and Batacuda, as you know, is like a Brazilian style. Very, very percussion heavy.
Yeah.
And so, and that song in particular, that track, I did use cuica. I've used it on a couple of other things in that score. But that would be one of the scores I was talking about where I got to kind of find my voice because the director was super talented, but we were very crunched for time. And I'm not sure he had worked with many composers before, and he liked my music, so he really let me have the reins. And I really was like, just went for it and went like creativity went bananas. So I recommend listening to that soundtrack because it is pretty wild and goofy. And there's this sense of joy that the main character has of setting all these records, but also this sort of like childlike goofiness because he is kind of and I mean this in a nice way, but an eccentric, goofy fella in some ways.
That's great, Silas. I'm going to check that out for sure. So for our listeners, anyone out there that is, thinking about contemplating moving into the creative space for a career beyond the book that you've recommended.
Mm-hmm.
What other recommendations or insights would you like to share?
Well, these days there's you can study creative fields so much easier than you could even 15 years ago when I was in college. There's so many classes about film scoring, or if you want to be an artist, you can go to, schools that teach that. And it's just so much more, it's at your fingertips now. You can do it online. There's a lot of great learning to be done online, things like that. So I would say, educate yourself, first
mm-hmm.
of all,
mm-hmm.
Talk to people in your field that are currently doing it and try and get some, insight that way. And then if you know specifically what you want to do, I think that's good advice, what I just gave. But if you're just not sure, but you're thinking you're not quite on the right path, I recommend, doing what I did. And you think about it. You just think about what do you like to do when you don't have to work, when you don't have any chores to do, you don't have any errands to run.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about like, a lot of us would just like to lounge by the pool or something. What I mean? I'm not talking about like, let's assume you've already taken a vacation and you're nice and relaxed and you're feeling like you've got energy, you want to do something. What would you like to do?
Yeah.
And you could do anything. What is it? And so maybe make a list or think about that and really, really ponder that. And that's kind of how I found my way, was asking myself that question. So I would try that.
Yeah, that's powerful, Silas. Thanks for sharing that. So we've shared a little bit about Be, Dream, Do, and Sean and I just would like to get your feedback and observations. How does the Be, Dream, Do theme resonate with you?
Well, I think, you know, being is being in your sort of being in touch with what you want, correct? Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong here.
Yeah.
Being is really honing in on what you want to do. So, like I said, you need to find what really inspires you and, you know, what you get excited about and think about that. Once you kind of, you know, have an idea, and I'm not saying you have to have a crystal clear idea, but have some thoughts around it or it's starting to form, then dream about where it can take you. You know, think about the different paths. For me, it was, you know, do I want to be a musician on the road, you know, playing in bands, or do I want to be a composer, or maybe do I want to be in the studio mixing? And you dream about all these different ways and think about the different possibilities. And I highly recommend writing these ideas down. Uh-huh. And then do. The third part is you figure out, well, what steps do I need to take towards these dreams? And you don't have to pick one right away. You can explore multiple ones if you need to until you can, you know, focus it down. But it's really about making and taking concrete steps. So again, write down ideas. What are some concrete steps that will take me closer to this goal? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of Neil Gaiman, the very successful writer, he gave a commencement speech a few years back. And one of the things that he said that I thought was really well put was he wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even sure what kind of writing. He wanted to do it all, basically. Mm-hmm. But he asks himself, does this particular thing in front of me take me a step closer towards the mountain being his goal of being a writer, does it take me away from it? And if it took him closer, he would do it. And if it doesn't, you know, then you don't do it. And so I think it's about really identifying steps that you can take, and will it take you closer to what you want to do or not? And then doing it.
You know, Silas, thank you for that. Listeners, we have just really been fortunate to listen to someone who is truly living his dream. And as Silas has shared, if you just stop and think about what is it that you'd like to do when you don't have anything else to do in terms of obligations, but something that really just interests you, then you're on to something. Silas, thank you for that insight. Everybody, welcome back to Be, Dream, Do next week. Remember, do what you love and love what you do.
Thank you for joining David and his guest. Make sure to catch Be, Dream, Do, Living by Design every week right here on StarWorldwideNetworks.com.